Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Georg Starke and I'm a physician and philosopher working on the ethics of AI and neuroscience at the Technical University of Munich. Our topic today sits at the intersection of two things that I think about in most of my current work, namely artificial intelligence and neurological clinical practice and research. And in today's episode, we want to address one question that sounds at first deceptively simple. Can neurologists trust AI? My guest today is Giulia Di Rauso, a neurologist and researcher with experience using AI models in clinical research in neurology. She used to work at the Movement Disorder Center of Reggio Emilia and is currently a fellow at the Fresco Institute for Parkinson's and Movement Disorders at NYU Langone Health in New York. Giulia, welcome and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Georg. Very happy to be here.
So before we dive in, I think it would be good to set the scene a little. As our listeners, of course, know, AI promises to reshape neurology in many areas, right? From seizure prediction and neuroimaging analytics to, let's say, closed-loop neurostimulation or AI-enabled brain-computer interfaces. And yet, despite all the excitement and all the things going on, adoption in clinical practice remains somewhat slower than many may have expected. And one of the points that commonly comes up when we think about this gap comes down to trust, or maybe rather its absence. So I would suggest that we start here. Giulia, can you tell us a bit about how you've been using AI in your own work?
Sure. Just to clarify, I come to this from a research angle rather than everyday clinical use. And so throughout our conversation, I will share my personal opinion from this perspective. As you mentioned, I'm involved in research mainly in the field of neurodegenerative diseases and Parkinson's disease, with a particular focus on genetic form of PD. I worked with a data scientist, and together we used AI and machine learning techniques to develop predictive models and to perform cluster analysis in patients' cohort. So, just to give a concrete example, we published a study conducted at the Movement Disorder Center of Reggio Emilia, whose main objective was to develop a machine learning model capable of providing a pre-estimate of GBA1 mutation status in PD patients based on clinical and demographic features with an high predictive value.
That's, I think, a really nice example to ground the conversation, because it brings up, at least to me, immediately the question that I imagine also many of our listeners will recognize, right? You can see the inputs and you can see the outputs, but the middle part, what the model is actually doing, can feel slightly opaque.
Yes, I can speak to this quite personally because I've experienced this feeling myself, actually, especially at the beginning. There were moments when I asked myself, how can I actually trust this result? Does it make sense clinically speaking?
Yeah, and I think this discomfort is somewhat widespread, right? And I want to return to it in a second. But first, I think since we are tackling this idea of trust here extensively, it's worth to also think about this at this stage a bit more carefully, because this notion of trust comes up in so many contexts involving AI, from marketing to regulation on the EU level, for instance. And yet there's actually something quite fundamental in here if we talk about trust and not just, say, about reliability or performance measures. Because when I rely on, for instance, a calculator, I probably don't trust it in any meaningful sense. I just expect it to perform a function. And if need be, I could actually also do the calculation myself by hand. But trust involves something more. It implies that there's some inherent risk in a complex situation, some kind of vulnerability, primarily, of course, for the patients, but potentially also for clinicians using these systems, for instance, in terms of liability. And this adds a normative dimension to trust that I find, of course, particularly interesting as an ethicist, and one that I also think is deeply linked to this model's opacity that you've mentioned.
Yes, one of the main obstacles, at least for me initially, was trusting the output because I couldn't fully see into how the model arrived at its result. So the famous black box problem. As I mentioned earlier, the first research project I worked on using AI was trying to develop a predictive model, and I remember this feeling quite clearly. The model would give us a prediction, but I found it difficult to understand where that result was coming from. This discussion can also be extended to the clinical context, you know, not just the research one. For example, when a model provides information about a patient prognosis, how can you understand where the result comes from and then explain them to the patients? I believe these are examples of the kind of situation people have in mind when they stress the importance of explainability, interpretability, and transparency of AI system, also when it comes to trust.
Yeah, I mean, I fully agree. These are concepts that help address common questions, such as, can I understand why this model flagged this particular patient? Do I know how it was built, on which data it was trained, and what I saw in two recent projects where we interviewed experts on AI in neurology and in psychiatry is that clinicians are quite pragmatic about this in a way. They don't necessarily want to understand the full architecture of the model, or at least many don't necessarily want to understand the full architecture of the model. But what they do want to know is, tell me what kind of input data this system was trained on. Show me how the output relates to something clinically meaningful. And I think this is the kind of interpretability, the level of interpretability that actually matters for clinical practice in many cases. And now, as you know, as someone working also in the field, a whole array of explainability tools, what researchers often call XAI, has of course improved substantially in the past years. And you can use techniques like CHAP to show you which features drove a particular prediction. And also, to be clear, I think this is really useful to understand how models work, especially at the stage of development. But something that the experts I spoke with also flagged here is that explainability, if it's not used properly, can also be misused or can become a kind of fig leaf to cover up deeper problems, such as bias training data, limited external validation, lack of accountability, and so on. And so I would say that if we just say this model is explainable, therefore you can trust it, that's almost certainly too simple an answer. And then this is only, again, considering the side of the model, but there's also a human side to actually understanding these explainability measures to make sense of them. So when AI tools arrive in clinical contexts without adequate education and training for the people who are actually supposed to use them, they wouldn't necessarily know how to properly interrogate them. So you could have a perfectly interpretable model, I think, but if clinicians haven't been taught what questions to ask here, this kind of interpretability may even be of limited use to them in practice.
Yes, you raise an important point. Thank you, Georg. I think AI is a tool, and like any tool, you need to understand the basic of how it works to use it properly. So, in my opinion, it would be important to provide a new neurologist who deals with AI with basic education and training in this field, so they can better understand its strengths and limitations, interpret its result, and use it in an informed and responsible way. In addition, you know, I think that education and knowledge are fundamental to building informed and well-grounded trust.
I certainly agree. And I mean, I think we have already touched on explainability, interpretability, transparency of AI models and their relation to trust. But from your perspective, as both a researcher and also a clinically working neurologist, what else do you think would be helpful to build some form of justified trust in AI in neurology?
In my opinion, an essential aspect is also recognizing the key role that humans play in the AI system. So not just as an user of the output, but as an active participant at everyday stage. This is important not only to build justified trust, but also to fully acknowledge our responsibility in the process and to ensure more conscious use of this tool. In addition, I think that by actively participating to this process, we can also make the system itself more trustworthy. Let's take a step back and schematically think of the AI process as a pipeline. Human provide data, the model process it and generate an output, and then human interpret and evaluate the result within their clinical context. So humans are present at both ends of the pipeline and play an active role throughout this process. I think that this pipeline also aligns several key points that are essential for improving the trustworthiness of AI system while also building informed trust.
That sounds very reasonable. Could you maybe guide us through what you have in mind here?
Yes, of course. Let's start with the input. First, this is absolutely fundamental, we need to ensure the quality of the input data. If the data are inaccurate or biased, the output will be unreliable, regardless of how sophisticated the model is. There's a well-known saying, garbage in, garbage out, and I think it fully applies here. Even the most advanced model will produce unreliable results if the data it is trained on are biased. And second, we need a clear and well-defined clinical question that justifies the use of AI. AI is not always the right tool and shouldn't be applied simply because it's available. The question should drive the model, not the other way around. So to trust the final output, we need first good quality data and a relevant question as the basis of a trustworthy system. Third, of course, we need to consider transparency, explainability, and clinically meaningful interpretability, as mentioned before. And finally, when it comes to the output, it is essential to maintain a critical stance and not rely on it in an unconditional and uncritical way. Even with good data, well-designed models, and interpretability tool, we must keep a critical perspective. We need to ask whether the output makes sense and whether it is appropriate for our specific clinical question. This helps us prevent over-reliance on an algorithmic results and ensure that clinical judgment remains central. Moreover, adopting a critical approach can also help uncover potential limitation of the model and ultimately contribute to improving it. What do you think about it?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about stressing these points. And it actually also helps me to drive home one point that I really believe can't be stressed enough here, namely that what ultimately matters is not that we just promote trust in AI for the sake of increasing trust. Trust can also be misplaced with potentially really dangerous consequences. So what we actually should aim for is making systems trustworthy, have, as you mentioned, better data, better validation, better explainability tools, and so on. But at the same time, we also mustn't forget that there's this genuinely human side to trust, right? We have already mentioned this with future education of end users, but it also relates, for instance, to communication, to framing of these AI tools, and to lived experience. And if we neglect this, I think that uptake of these tools will almost certainly stall. So in my view, it's, for instance, absolutely crucial that we involve all relevant stakeholders early on, including both patients and clinicians, in the development of these AI systems in some kind of co-design process, ideally. And my worry, but this is of course the ethicist speaking here, is that instead of focusing on properly building trust, we sometimes just aim to increase trust through marketing, for instance, without also making sure that there is underlying trustworthiness that's grounded in this kind of thorough process. And of course, this may speed up things at first, but if we do so, we actually risk later on misplacing trust. And we also risk that things go really wrong and that we disrupt existing relations of trust in medicine, most importantly between patients and physicians. And I think these will be quite hard to patch later on. So I think this is something that I think it's really worth stressing here.
Thank you, Georg, for sharing your perspective. I think you have highlighted a crucial point. It is not just about increasing trust, but also ensuring that the system are trustworthy. But from your point of view, what do you think should actually be improved?
I mean, that's a big question. I think with view to trust, it really matters whom we have in mind when we talk about trust. Most discussions typically focus on individual clinicians or individual patients in our Western countries. So do you, as a neurologist or potentially as a patient, trust this specific AI-enabled tool? But trust is also a public, an institutional, and in fact, to some extent, also a global phenomenon. And I think each of these levels deserves attention. Because at the public level, we've seen in recent years how quickly trust can erode, also in the context of medicine, not necessarily because a technology fails, but because of how it is governed and how it's communicated. And in the field that we are talking about, controversies around companies like Neuralink are a good example here. The problem here wasn't necessarily the technology itself, but Thunder Park trial reporting or perceived conflicts of interest or the perception that private actors were moving faster than accountability structures could keep up with. And once that kind of skepticism takes hold in the public imagination, the public perception of a field, it doesn't necessarily stay contained there. It spills over and casts doubt on adjacent areas on the entire field. And that, I believe, matters for every neurologist who wants to use AI responsibly in their clinic, because your patients don't arrive as blank slates. They arrive with whatever they've read, what they've heard or experienced. Second, at the institutional level, I think we need also institutional safeguards, systematic auditing of AI tools, for instance, in deployment, clear accountability structures when a model fails, and also governance frameworks that go beyond simply ticking regulatory boxes. Within Europe, the UAI Act, for instance, is a meaningful step here, as it mandates human oversight, includes transparency requirements, and also, for instance, post-marketing monitoring for high-risk systems such as AI used in neurology. And also on a more international level, there's an increasing attention that this intersection of AI and neuroscience and neurotechnology requires specific regulation, as mirrored in, for instance, last year's recommendations on the ethics of neurotechnology from the UNESCO, which you may be familiar with. But I want to be clear, these frameworks are important and they can create conditions under which trust can flourish, but they cannot create these complex and also somewhat vulnerable webs of trust themselves. And last but not least, on a third point, on this more global level, there's a dimension that I think is often, unfortunately, underappreciated, which is that most of the AI tools being developed and validated in neurology are actually built on data from a relatively narrow slice of the world, predominantly from well-resourced Western clinical settings. But if those tools are then deployed globally, or if they shape the standards by which AI in neurology is evaluated on a global scale, we have a trust problem that isn't just a clinical problem, but it's also really a justice problem. And of course, if you add this to the huge environmental costs of training AI models that may disproportionately affect people in other parts of the world, this problem of justice, I believe, becomes even more pronounced. Now, these questions of justice are not an entirely new problem, right? We see similar issues with much medical progress, but then with AI, it becomes potentially even more wide-reaching. I do want to conclude on a more positive note, because among all these concerns, I think it's also crucial that we don't lose sight of the fact that there's a real potential here. AI tools that can predict or even prevent seizures, that can detect neurodegenerative diseases early on, that can support us in finding the best therapy for individual patients are, I believe, genuinely great. But in turn, this potential is why, in my view, it's really worth getting these questions of trust right, precisely because there's so much at stake. Julia, any final thoughts?
Yes, I believe it's important, as I mentioned earlier, especially given the increasing use of AI system, to stay informed and educate ourselves so that we can approach them as urologists in a more informed and responsible way, avoiding both prejudice and uncritical trust.
Yeah, with this I really agree. And in fact, this seems like a perfect way probably to end today's session, as it shows that we are not only completely passive recipients of this technology, but also have some degree of agency and for this also some responsibility to shape its integration into our work as far as we can.
Thank you so much, Georg, and thank everyone for listening.
No, thank you, Julia. And yeah, thank you all for listening. If this topic interests you, there will also be more content on EANcast this month on AI. So stay tuned. Thank you.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.